Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
The author. If you'll open your Bibles to Colossians chapter 1, verse 1, you'll see there's two authors. Now, that may surprise you. Paul wrote this, but it was Paul and Timothy who are writing to the church at Colossae. Now, how much of it is Timothy, we do not know. We know that the Apostle Paul wrote it, and Timothy is there with him, and it almost seems like they co-authored it. Both of them are sitting there talking back and forth to the Christians at Colossae. Now, if you'll notice on the chart over there, the prison epistle, Paul was in prison. We feel like that this is Rome. The Bible never says that Paul was in prison at Rome when he wrote this. It just says Paul in prison. And we learned that from several verses through here. Chapter 4, verse 10, chapter 4, verse 18 of Colossians says, Paul a prisoner. Now, some scholars have thought it's referring to the imprisonment at Caesarea by the Sea in Palestine. That doesn't fit real well with the book of Acts. Some theorize that he was in prison at Ephesus, though we have no record anywhere of that. I think the safest thing to say that Paul is in prison at Rome from about 58 to 62, somewhere in there, 2 years. 2 years, somewhere in there, he's in prison. And so he wrote the book of Colossians, the book of Ephesians, and the book of Philemon very close together. Colossians and Ephesians are almost parallel, thought for thought, chapter to chapter. I mean, you can almost take the book of Ephesians and put it down and put the book of Colossians down the next side of the page and almost match up every verse. There's 88 references to the book of Ephesians in your reference Bible, if you have one, in Colossians. Now, 88 references. There's only 70 of all other New Testament epistles. So what we have here, the book of Colossians is a very sharp, terse, apologetic witness to a church facing heresy. The book of Ephesians is a very thought out, logical, smooth, deep treatment of the same subject, but done with more thought and more time. Now, the reason that Philemon was done the same time that Ephesians and Colossians was, Philemon is a runaway slave that had somehow got to Rome. And Paul met him and he was converted. But his master, the master's name is Philemon, the slave's name, is Onesimus. Yeah, it's tough when you're used to Ralph and John and Bob and Sam. Onesimus. Now, he was in Rome, and Paul was sending him back to his master saying, I've met this man, he's a Christian, you treat him like a Christian brother, but I'm sending him back to you. So we find that Tychicus, now that's a rough name, took the letter of Colossians, Ephesians, and Philemon back at the same time. And we find that in Colossians 4:7 and Ephesians 6:21. And it is obvious from the book of Philemon that the man lived in Colossae and it was sent the same time. Now, when I did that chart, I hadn't done as much extensive study as I have now on the dating of Paul's prison epistle. But in my opinion, the book of Philippians that's listed right under Colossians there, right under 61 A.D., I think was written separately. Now, how much separately, I don't know. A month, 2 months, 6 months, year and a half, I can't say. But the situation has changed in the book of Philippians enough to say that at the same week that Paul wrote Ephesians and Colossians, he did not write Philippians. Philippians is later down the time somewhere because in the book of Colossians and Ephesians, there are a lot of people there. There's Luke, there's Timothy, there's Epaphras, and on Philippians, there's not very many people there. In these early prison epistles, Paul says, I hope to be released, but I'm not sure. In Philippians, he is sure he will be released very soon. So you see, one goes toward the end of his imprisonment, the other three go toward the beginning. All right? Now, the date again would be somewhere between 58 and 62. I put 61 on there. That's as good as any. somewhere around there. Now, let's look at the recipient, the church. And let me get you, I need you to lower the screen, Bruce, if you would, up there, and turn these spotlights off. Okay, Dave, let me turn that thing on. The whole world came to our church. The city of Colossae, in ancient times, was an extremely large, commercial, prosperous city. Now, you see where it is there? Now, that whole body of land, Bithynia, Galatia, Pamphylia, and all the rest, that's modern-day Turkey. It's known in the Bible as Asia Minor, okay? It's modern-day Turkey. It goes by those little names sometimes when Paul's writing to a particular locale. If we had the rivers in there, we would see that Ephesus and Colossae are on the same river. Now, the river that comes out by Ephesus is called the Meander. And one of the tributaries to the Meander is the Lycus River, L-Y-C-H-U-S. And that's what Colossae is on. So it's one great valley from Colossae to Ephesus. Well, the trade route was changed by the Romans. They built a new road. And the new road bypassed Colossae. And therefore, by the time of Paul, Colossae was a little bitty city. It's so little, it's never even mentioned in the book of Acts. It just is very, very small by Paul's day. The church there was made up, apparently, mostly of Gentiles with some Jews. We learn from the Jewish historian, Josephus, Flavius Josephus, who wrote during the time of Christ, that back during, remember when we studied Daniel, remember the evil king, the evil Syrian king, Antiochus Epiphanes III, remember him, Antiochus III, called Antiochus the Great? He transported 2,000 Jews from Babylonia, which is way back over here on this map, and settled them in that valley where Colossae is. Way, way early. Now, by the year 62, 63, make sure my date's here. I'd hate to get it 1 B.C. off. By 67 B.C., we find in the district where Colossae is the capital that there was 11,000 Jewish males. Now, that didn't include the women and children, just Jewish males. So there was a large Jewish settlement in this river valley. Okay? Now, the other cities that aren't mentioned here, you see Laodicea. The other one is Hierapolis, that's also mentioned in the book of Acts. Laodicea is about 10 miles away. Hierapolis is about 6 miles away. So these are very close together. They're in a very fertile valley. Matter of fact, the city of Colossae was the ancient world's leading producer of wool and dyed wool. This volcanic riverbed, tremendous for raising cattle and sheep, a lot of grass. It was also bad for earthquakes. It was destroyed several times, a very unsettled kind of region. Well, that's the church. It's a pretty small church by now. It's not real big. The church was started by a man named Epaphras. Now, we find him in Colossians 1, 7, and 8, and Vern read you that. As you see, heard about your love and all. So Epaphras visited Paul in prison in Rome to tell him what was happening about the church at Colossae. Now, my own opinion is that this church was founded not by Paul, because in chapter 2, verse 1, Paul says, "You've never seen my face." And so, of course, that implies that he isn't the one that preached there and didn't even know the Christians there. But Paul had an extended ministry in what city? 2 years in what city? Ephesus. And in Acts 19, verse 10, it says, "And all Asia heard the gospel going out from Ephesus." So I think Epaphras heard Paul preach in Ephesus and went back home to his hometown of Colossae, started the church there. Epaphras is also mentioned in chapter 4, verses 12 and 13 of the book of Colossians. So he's mentioned several times. Ephesus is 100 miles away, not very far at all. If you remember our introduction to the book of Ephesians, you remember that Ephesus was not the only city Paul wrote to. That letter that we have called the Ephesians is really a circular letter that was meant for all the churches in this region. The seven churches, the book of the Revelation, Sardis, Philadelphia, Pergamum, they're all right there in that a little circle around the city of Ephesus and Colossae. Okay? They're written to all those churches. And we have two letters going to the very same area. All right. Let's look at the local situation. That's very important. Why did Paul write this letter? Some things that Epaphras told him really, really bothered him. The book of Colossians is going to be one of the most significant theological studies that we do this year. Now, Peter, we're going to do 1 and 2 Peter after this. That'll be a very good epistle of a later persecution. We're going to do Philippians later on in the year. That'll be a good book about Paul's love affair with the church. But this is the key theology book this year for us. Now, why is it so key theologically? There was a heresy that had developed in this whole region that brought into question the uniqueness of the person of Jesus Christ. It was a mixture of several different kinds of things that said Christ is good, but you got to do this, you got to do that, you got to believe this, you got to believe that. So it made Christ one of many instead of one overall. And as you can imagine, that is a terrible heresy. Now, I want you to remember this. Heresy never comes from people outside the church. Heresy comes from people in the church that subtly twist some doctrine or emphasize one thing to the exclusion of all else. Now, we have Jewish people and pagans, and both of them are in the church. And what we have is an unusual blend here, not like Galatians completely with the Judaizers. It's a little different in that situation. But it is a unique blend of Greek philosophy and Jewish ceremonialism. Now let's look at some of the places where this appears and exactly what it's called. In chapter 2, verse 8, Paul calls this teaching a false philosophy. Now that tells me it's not basically a theology, it's not basically a rival religion, but it is a philosophy. Now that speaks of it being Greek. Now Greek philosophy, as you know, accentuates the spiritual and downplays the material. It says, let's turn the lights back up for a minute. It says, everybody go sleep. Quit yawning, Tony. It says that the body is bad. The spirit is good. It would say stuff like the body is the prison of the soul. Now, that is just opposite from Christianity. It says that we will have a body in eternity. One of the unique things of Christianity is that we're never going to be in a disembodied state very long. And even between our death and the resurrection, we are in an incomplete state. Well, this took several forms. One form it took was asceticism, or punishing the body, not feeding it. Did you know that many times, even in the Middle Ages, in the Roman Catholic Church, that monks would wear pig skins with the bristles on the inside to show how much they love God? Well, that'll give you a rash. We find this asceticism in chapter 2, verse 20 through 23, where it's talking about putting the body down. Be ugly to your body. The more you don't brush your teeth, the more spiritual you are. You know, there's even records in the some of the Middle Ages of monks who could show their piety by how many lice would fall off them when they walked. Now, that's the same kind of thing as being taught by these Greek philosophers, you know. The more you beat your body, the more you hurt it, the more you make it uncomfortable, the more spiritual you are. You ever meet anybody like that? Yeah, I have too. Now, it's not mentioned in this epistle, but usually the other extreme is also present. And what's that? Yee-haw, let's live it up. The body's bad, it don't make any difference. Whatever you want to do is okay. Now, that's called libertinism, antinomianism. And it just says, if it doesn't make any difference, the body and spirit are separate, whatever you want to do, do it. Well, both of those extremes are obviously wrong. Now, the second element here that we need to blend in with this Greek philosophy, by the way, most commentaries you read, if you buy some of those I gave you, will call this Gnosticism. Now, the Greek word for knowledge is gnosis, and so it's a play on intellectuals. This is the guys who would have, I got a spiritual secret club. And if you want in, you come listen to me. We have those in our day too, don't we? But I don't think that we can say this is Gnosticism, because we don't have any real knowledge of Gnosticism until the 2nd century, 100 years later. We might want to call this incipient Gnosticism or beginning Gnosticism, but we can't say this is the full-blown Gnosticism that later developed in Valentinianism and all that. They had a whole lot of series of emanations between God and man. Since God was holy and couldn't touch sinful matter, then you got to have a whole series of gods. And one of these lesser gods is the God Jehovah or Yahweh of the Old Testament. And Jesus is one of these gods. That's what the 2nd century Gnostics taught. And you had to have a knowledge of the magical words, and you had to know these gods by name to get through all of them to get to heaven. But you can't read that 2nd century full-blown Gnostic system back here in the book of Colossians, although the beginning forms of it are here. Jesus, yes, but he's just one of many, is also already present, but not full-blown yet. Jewish elements were here. There was a large amount of Jews, and they accepted Christ, but wanted to keep a lot of their Jewish things. You find this in chapter 2, verse 11, chapter 2, verse 16 and 17, and chapter 3, verse 11, where it talks about circumcision. Remember, that was the Judaizers that came to Galatia. Now, remember on the map, Galatia is very close to Colossae. Okay, but it's a little different in Colossians. It's a lot more Greek than just Jewish. They worshipped angels. Now, whether it was angel worship coming out of Greek philosophy through Zoroastrianism, or whether it was angelology coming out of Judaism, I don't know. But they worshipped angels. And really, I think that when I said the word angels, I'd probably throw you. It's this series of emanations between a holy God who can't touch matter and matter. And these angels would be the different steps. And so you can see how it developed. The planets and stars became part of that. And, you know. So those are the basic elements. It's a Greek philosophy. It's Jewish. It has angel worship. And it emphasized asceticism. Okay? The great problem here was that they were taking away from the person of Christ. If it hadn't been for this heresy, I don't know where Paul would have ever dealt with the theme of this book, and I want to give you the theological emphasis in two statements. The theme of this book is the cosmological lordship of Christ. Jesus isn't sitting over the earth saying, "This belongs to me." Jesus is sitting over the galaxies and saying, "This belongs to me. I made it. I keep it. I sustain it." Jesus is not Lord of the earth, the Mediterranean area. Everything that exists, Jesus is Lord. And the more we go into space and the farther we probe and the more things that we find out there, every time we come to something that just staggers our imagination in its immensity and in its size, I want you to remember that Jesus is Lord of all the created order, and that's the book of Colossians. You don't go any higher than the throne that Jesus is on, for he is on the throne of all creation that is. Second, the theological emphasis that these heretics call Paul to emphasize is the absolute uniqueness of the person of Jesus Christ. Paul puts it this way. There is one mediator between God and man, Jesus Christ. One, only one. In him is the fullness of the Godhead bodily. I want to tell you, this is the book where Jesus Christ is lifted up like no other book in the New Testament and set on the pinnacle of all creation, and everything bows the knee to him. That's the book of Colossians. So we're going to have to understand the background and the heresy, because you will not understand the book if you don't understand the background. And I want us to continue to say those two great things, the lordship of Christ over the cosmos and the uniqueness of Christ as the one mediator between God and man. Well, basically, that's the introduction tonight. I don't know if you have questions or not, but we'll give you a chance to talk about the book of Colossians some, if you'd like to. If you don't have something like this in some book at your house, you might want to take the bottom of your page or the top of your page and try to write little and get this thing on there. You got enough room, make two different deals, and you can get most of that on there if you'll put it on there. If you have a blank page in the front or back of your Bible, that ought to go on it. Now you say, well, I don't have that much time. Well, you got a few minutes. We're 10 minutes early. And if you just want to move over here and copy that, I think it'd be very helpful. Put those dates in there. Remembering, those dates aren't absolutely 100% accurate, but they're close. And where those books appear, I don't have all the books in the New Testament because we don't know where all the books went. The ones that I think I can pinpoint, I wrote in there. The ones that I have no idea of, I left out. So, any questions about Colossians that we'll start chapter 1 next Sunday night? Yes, Larry? What now? Yes. Right. The Hebrews were always very modest people, but they never made their body evil, because, see, even the Pharisees expected a resurrection of the body. And so it's only the Greeks. And, you know, I have a personal theory I'll share with you. This is R.J. I think as the Greek intellectuals, and they were the greatest minds, I think, as far as philosophy, there is nobody to beat the Greek philosophers as far as their logical systems of thought. I think if those men let their minds expand to try to understand everything it was, they still realized how far short they fall personally of what their minds were thinking. And as they continued to fall short ethically, morally, spiritually, of the greatness of the concepts their mind was thinking, they couldn't live. And I think it's the fallen sin nature of man that caused those great Greek philosophers to say, the body's evil, it's evil for everybody, and we're going to get ourselves loose from this evil thing and float up here in the peripheral intelligence, abstract stuff. And I think it's because of their sin nature they just could not handle. Most of them, a lot of them, were very immoral people. And so I think they had a tremendous problem with their own ethics. That's why that thing developed in these Greek philosophers. But that's just, we can't document that for nothing. I hope you see tonight why it is so important that you just can't sit at your breakfast table some bright early morning, plop the Bible open to Colossians and say, God, fill me up. Without a knowledge of something about Colossians, you will misinterpret that book almost every place that false teaching comes in, because you'll read your understanding of those terms, your American understanding of those terms, right into that text. If you don't know something of Paul's day and the problems in Paul's day and the historical setting of the book of Colossians, that's why, people, the Bible is a book that demands to be interpreted in the light of its day. And you just can't pray, Holy Spirit, open my mind and jump in that book without some understanding of the author and his day and his purpose and the setting of the book and on and on. So I really do challenge you, buy one of those commentaries, or buy, if you got one at home, on Colossians, read it. You know, I've been doing this many seminars around, and it amazes me. People tell me, you know, I got some of those books at home, never use them. I tell you what, you can't sleep on those books and the knowledge osmosis into your head. You know, you got to read them to get it, and it takes a little time. But something as great as the cosmological lordship of Jesus, something as fundamental as the person of Jesus Christ, isn't that worth a couple hours of your time before you come here on Sunday night? I think it is. I think it is. And you'll get three times out of our study if you'll just read one little commentary before you come and pray. Okay? Any questions? Yes, ma'am. Okay, where are those in the back? Somebody got those in the back? Hold them up if you got them. I'm looking for that one by Curtis Vaughn. That's it. See that red one back there? It's by Curtis Vaughn. It's a Zondervan publication. Costs $2 or so. And I think it's the best overall quick overview and good theology. Curtis Vaughn, I think it's, what is it called, Nanette? Colossians, right? Difficult title. Book of Colossians, Zondervan Publishers, Curtis Vaughn, author. Okay. I think that's one of the easiest ones to read. A.T. Robertson's back on this side. Who has that? Big red book. Paul, Letter to the Intellectuals. A.T. Robertson. Put out by Broadman, isn't it? Look on the side. Yeah. Doesn't say? Okay. It's a good one, too.